Going Linux, episode 204, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your chief executive minion, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all episodes helpful in going Linux.
In today's episode, listener feedback. Well, Bill, Kevin O'Brien, publicity director of the Ohio Linux Fest, has asked us to announce this. Ohio Linux Fest is looking for talks for our 2013 event, which will be held September 13th through 15th, 2013, in Columbus, Ohio. We are looking for a variety of talks at all levels, from beginners through intermediate to advanced. Any topic related to free and open source software or to open hardware is fair game for a talk. If you have something to say, we'd love to offer you an opportunity to say it. Just go to www.ohiolinux.org/CFP and fill out the submission form. Thank you. And thanks, Kevin, for reminding us of Ohio Linux Fest. That's great.
You've been to a Linux Fest, haven't you, Larry?
Yes, I've been to the one out here on the West Coast, Scale, Southern California Linux Expo. I've been a few times, and I've even presented there.
I've never been. I really got to do that one day.
Oh, yeah. You'd love it. You'd love it. You get to talk to a lot of geeky people like ourselves.
Oh, okay. Hey, Larry.
Yeah.
Been playing with OpenSUSE.
I heard that. I read that in your Skype messages back and forth. How's that going?
I like it. It's fast.
OpenSUSE is one of the first Linux distributions that I actually used for any extended length of time. I really liked it as well when I was using it.
I'm using the GNOME. I don't really like the KDE version of it, but they say that the KDE version is one of the best that they've ever seen.
Yeah, I was using it in the pre-KDE 4 iteration, so that's when I was actually using KDE on a regular basis.
I know that it loaded fast. I don't know what they did differently, but it loads faster than when Ubuntu loads on my machine. Yeah, I don't know what they did, but they did add where it works with UEFI. And it looks for secure boot. Of course, my new computer has UEFI, but it also pops up and says secure boot not enabled. Mine doesn't have secure boot on it. But what was really
or not enabled?
Not enabled. I've looked into BIOS just to see if there was an option. I think I don't have an older version of the BIOS. I don't think it was implemented. And I'm not going to mess with the BIOS. It can just stay right where it is. Or it works just fine. But, yeah, it works great, loads fast, and I'm still playing with it. I actually liked it so much when I was running the virtual machine that I put it on a spare hardware I have, and it's sitting right over here looking at me going, come play with me. So you know what I'll be doing today.
So the OpenSUSE implementation of GNOME, is it GNOME 3? What are they using?
GNOME 3. I'm not a big fan of GNOME 3. It's just so different from Unity. But it's nice. I just don't like having to. It kind of reminds me a little bit of having to the Windows 8 when you have to go to the side. I never really liked that to bring up the menus and stuff. I know you can change it and theme it and stuff, but, you know, I can't be bothered to do that.
Well, you can always install Cinnamon or something on there. And
I don't know if I don't know if you can get Cinnamon on OpenSUSE.
You know what? I think you can, but
I'd have to go look.
Come to think of it, I haven't heard about Cinnamon specifically on OpenSUSE. But anyway, I'm sure they have it somewhere.
But they have a really cool service that it's called the OpenSUSE Build Service. You can build packages for OpenSUSE and other distributions. I haven't played a lot with it. I've looked at it and I found a few packages. But the funny part of OpenSUSE is, you know, I always have like a standard applications that I use, and GPotter, for some reason, I always have trouble finding GPotter on OpenSUSE. I do not know why. And I couldn't find FFmpeg. I'm still looking. I'm not saying it's not there. I just probably, you know, I think a little bit like Ubuntu, so they do things a little differently.
Yeah, I remember, and of course this was quite a while ago, but I remember that to get everything that I needed to do recording of the podcast on OpenSUSE back then, I had to enable some additional repositories.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't able to find everything within the standard repositories that come with OpenSUSE. So that may be what you need to do as well.
Yeah, I've just been amazed by the speed and the stability of it. It runs great. I wouldn't say it's a Ubuntu killer, but it's about the closest I've found so far of being friendly to install. Of course, when I installed it on the, I have another machine that uses UEFI. You have to know to tell it to write the EFI boot portion. It's a drop down menu. I think it says grub and with EFI or something to that effect. The first time I installed it, I didn't catch it and it didn't install. Oh, it installed, but it didn't boot. And
UEFI is, we got to find another name for that. That's hard to pronounce.
It's a pain. I don't like it. Getting back to the old BIOS, it's so much easier to use.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I was going to talk about for a second here. I've been browsing around in several forums and reading things on UEFI or Secure Boot, and it depends on your hardware and your computer manufacturer's implementation of it. My understanding of UEFI is that it is meant to replace the BIOS.
Mm-hmm.
Just generally speaking, it's meant to replace the BIOS. And I've read that if you're installing Ubuntu or one of the others that has the Microsoft blessed Kiss the Ring of the Pope key, then you can just install it and it takes care of things, especially with Ubuntu. But on some hardware,
mm-hmm.
all you need to do is go into where you boot and turn off UEFI. On other hardware, you need to do that, but there's no documentation on how to do it. And on yet other hardware, you actually have to go into the BIOS, make a change there, and then you're able to turn off UEFI. So it doesn't sound like there's any standard implementation of it. And if you want it to just work, Ubuntu seems to be the one that has the best workaround for it, mm-hmm. or the best keys for it, or the best implementation of the keys for it. So still a lot of work to be done to make it work seamlessly with all distributions. But hopefully by the time I get a UEFI computer, you know, Linux Mint or whatever distribution I'm working with, that point mm-hmm. has it all working and I don't have to worry about it.
Well, you know, the update release of Ubuntu 12.04 added a bunch of that UEFI options, because I downloaded the new ISO, and so I don't have to do so many updates because, you know, I'm constantly messing with my stuff. And I see that it sees the UEFI and then it just does what it needs to do. It creates that special partition. On my machine, you can disable it right from, you know, you hit F2 when it's booting and you can go in and you can turn it off. But not knowing, you know, how that affects everything, I just kind of just say, hey, let Ubuntu figure it out. So.
Right. Hey, I've heard that and read that Windows 8 actually is installed by default in four partitions. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, on my Windows 8 machine, there is a system reserved, a restore partition, I believe, something else, and another partition. There's four partitions. There's the EFI partition, the system reserve partition, your main partition, and a restore partition.
Wow. So for folks attempting to install their Linux with manual partitioning, they would want to shrink the main partition, I guess, and leave the other ones as is.
Yeah. I need to think here for a minute. Yeah, I believe that's the way you'd want to do it. I haven't had a lot of luck mainly it's because I'm incompetent, most likely. But... But I've never really had a lot of luck getting them to be installed side by side. You actually have to do something different. I've solved the problem by just putting on different machines or running them in a virtual box. That's a good thing you could try is that you could go ahead and install like VirtualBox and install the version of Ubuntu that you want. Or Ubuntu or any Linux, and look at the installer and get an idea of it before you actually try it on the physical hardware.
Yeah, that's probably the best.
Yeah, I say use the virtual machine when you can. But I've messed up more machines than I can shake a stick at.
That's how we learn, Bill. That's how we learn.
Yeah, my poor machine's like, okay, how many times are you going to mess up today? And it says today, and it means today. What do you say we get onto these emails before we rat hole this really badly?
Okay, no problem. So, first of all, we received a voicemail from Scott Dowdle, and we received only the first two sentences of his voicemail, I should say. So I don't really know whether his phone connection dropped out or something happened to Google Voice, but that's all we got.
We asked Scott to try again, and he responded with this email. He said, "Me being a Fedora fanboy, I was just scolding Bill for his comments about Fedora and that someone must be really brave to try Fedora 18. While Fedora 18 did have all new Anaconda-based installer, and that a lot of people have complained about changes to the disk partitions of it, it really isn't that hard to use and is darn stable. At least it has been for me. Yeah, Fedora does have a fire hose of updates, but that's just because they take more rapid action on their bug reports. Talk to you later, Scott." Well, okay. I'm sorry, Scott. My poor humor. I like Fedora. I just think it's a little too bleeding edge to run as a day-to-day, but that's just me. And so I stand scolded. And the reason that your message got cut off is that the answering machine's in my office, and I heard you're scolding me, so I turned it off.
Yeah. Not really. But sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, our next email is from James. He writes, "Hi, Larry and Bill. In case the search was successful after his in-flight plane reconfiguration, hi, Tom. I am in the process of automating several services on my home server. One thing I would like to do is to be able to take an audio file, AUG, MP3, or WAV, and generate a text file from it. The translation does not have to be perfect, just passable. I record meetings and presentations often. Currently, I have to listen to them to take notes. A text version would allow quick searching and skimming to see about where in the recording to listen. The basic idea is simple. I record on my portable device, Nexus 7, have the recordings sync to my home server, own cloud, webdav, or SFTP, when I have an internet connection. A script will run on the server looking for new audio files. New files will be processed to generate text translations, text or HTML, possibly with time marks inserted in translation. Another script would take the recorded files to generate an RSS feed. The RSS feed will feed into my reading queue for review, currently Google Reader. On a sad note, Google Reader is retiring. I have several alternatives, but none of them seem to fit. The features I like are that I have multiple devices I read the feeds from, 5 desktops, 2 Android phones, and 1 Android tablet, and a few others which stay synchronized. The server also continuously polls in the background so that when I read, it doesn't wait for a bit while it's checking every source. I have had several services that seem to drop or change at their preference, so something I can host on my own server would be preferred. I'm looking for recommendations on 2 applications. 1, converter for audio files, text to HTML. 2, replacement for Google Reader that I could host on my own server. Okay, James. Well, audio files, conversion from text to HTML. Audio files, huh? Mm.
Got me there.
Yeah. So I did a little bit of research on this, and I found a couple of voice-to-text converters that are currently actively in development. Voice recognition on Linux quite a few years ago was way behind anything, but with the advent of cell phones that have voice recognition, Google's advances in that area, and of course Apple's advances in that area, it's got a lot of resurgence, shall we say. And there are a couple that I have found. One is something that I recently ran across, something called Sphinx, S-P-H-I-N-X. And it is either Pocket Sphinx and CMU Sphinx, hard to say, from Carnegie Mellon University, and they're under active development. And in fact, in the form of Python-Pocket Sphinx, they are actually in the Ubuntu, Linux Mint, and Fedora repositories. So they are ways of converting audio into text. And there's also something that is actively being developed that looks like it's being run by one guy, and it is called Palaver. And we'll have links in the show notes to each of those in case you're interested in either of those. So Palaver I found on my own, and it is there's a YouTube video for it too. We'll include that in the show notes. And Pocket Sphinx is something that actually in my exchanges with James, he led me to, and I've taken a look at it. I haven't had a chance to try it, but I did try the other one. I tried Palaver. Mm-hmm. And although it's early in its development and still needs some work, it does work, and it's kind of interesting. So if you're interested in trying to make your own voice recognition, or if Jonathan Nadeau wants to put this in Sonar, if he doesn't already have something like that, then this would be something for him to, either of these would be something for him to take a look at.
I think he uses something now that does it, but I can't remember what he, because, you know, he goes to school, and is it the other way around?
It's a screen reader that I've heard him talk about, so I don't know about voice recognition. So what the difference would be is you would be converting text to speech as opposed to speech to text, right? So voice recognition would be where you talk to your computer and it either navigates through Windows or types the text on the screen.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's right. I have no clue about that, but I will say he said he was looking for a replacement for Google Reader, didn't he?
Oh yes, Google Reader, right? Yeah. Do you have any recommendations?
I don't, but I can point him in the right direction. The Linux Action Show is actually doing an episode, I think the next one they're doing, about self-hosted Google Reader replacements.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, we don't live in a bubble, so you know, I think that those guys are do a pretty good job. I think they're going to have a, like I said, they're going to have an episode pretty soon.
Yeah. Okay, that'd be great. I've actually tried a couple. I've settled on Feedly, and Pulse isn't actually an RSS reader. It's kind of a subscription to news type services. I'm sure they use RSS or something like it on the back end. And then there's an old reader. I don't know how old the old reader is, but it's called the old reader.
The old
really? And it's a replacement as well.
It's called the old reader?
There are plenty of lists. Yes, it's actual name, old reader. So we'll have links to those three, as well as links to one of the many, many reviews of different kinds of alternatives to Google Reader that are available for you. So plenty of lists out there. But we'll include a list from Donna Papacosta of the Trafcom News podcast, okay. Podcast I listen to. She did a blog post on five alternatives to Google Reader. So there you go.
That's really caused a lot of people to spaz out, hasn't it? You know, when since they're going to retire Google Reader.
Well, it's not like they didn't announce it early enough. I mean, come on. Anyway,
our next email is from a listener and a regular member of the Computer America chat room called KY Engineer. He writes, "Hello, Larry, Tom, and Bill." Hey,
hi, KY.
I have been listening to your show for a while and have become a Linux fan. Good for you. I want to host a web server for my home. This is a hobby project. I am running an Apache web server on Ubuntu server operating system in a virtual box on my PC. I want to make my website available on the internet. The computer sits on my home network that is connected to the internet by ATT Uverse. I have found the broadband IPv4 address. It's and he lists 107.210.xxx.xxx. The problem is I can't see the web site from the internet. I have set up port forwarding in my router. I think the problem is in the VirtualBox setup. Can you or someone in the chat room point me in the right direction? I believe one of the chat room regulars knows about virtual machines. Thanks, KY Engineer.
Yeah, I think that Inet Ken in the chat room is the person who's been doing the things with VirtualBox and these kinds of things. But, you know, there's a tutorial that Nightwise has done. He's done several, as a matter of fact, on setting up a home server. And I believe, if I remember correctly, he's talked about setting up in a virtual machine. And I think there's some trick that you have to do to ensure that your virtual machine is communicating in the same network node as the rest of your network, or at least to get it to pass through. So we'll have links in the show notes to Nightwise's post and video and audio on running your own home server, the Sliders Academy episode 504 and Sliders Academy part 2 episode 506. All three of those are places where Nightwise has discussed this at length and with much more expertise than either of us have, I think.
Oh, Bill. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I won't even try to touch that one.
Okay.
I break my computers enough by it myself.
Our next email is from Nick, who wrote, "Hi, guys."
Hi, Nick. Hi, Nick.
Something I have not heard mention is Mom and Dad are going to make 2013, 2014 the years of the Linux desktop / device because. Because if you're going to learn a new, disastrous, unintuitive GUI, then why not do it for free? Why would you pay someone to ruin your PC life? We could argue whether or not Linux in its various flavors is or isn't intuitive. The perception is it's for geeks and propeller heads. As soon as Ubuntu gets some traction in the mainstream marketplace, attention will be attracted and Linux variety will be exposed. Perception will be dispelled and people will take the risk. The alternative is to take the risk with Windows 8. They'll feel they're being burnt with Windows 8. I've been using Windows since Windows 95, and they go and do this, Windows 8, to me. They don't care about me. They gave me that rubbish Vista. Now they're doing it again. That's it. I'm out of here. And those were all kind of quotes that Nick was relaying to us there. Linux needs exposure desperately to gain from this. Some will jump to iOS. As Windows 7 support and marketing comes to a close, we should see a commensurate rise in downloads of and weblog traffic for Linux, probably Ubuntu and Mint to follow. If this data is not seen during this golden opportunity, the Linux desktop will remain a niche propellerhead environment and battle for attention. Regards, Nick. Well, Nick, I would agree that now's the time. We're nowhere near dropping support for Windows 7, but we're getting near dropping support for Windows XP. And yeah, I think now's the time, or at least now is an opportunity for us to convert some people who may be upset with or dissatisfied with Windows 8 or just simply dissatisfied with learning a new, completely new way of interacting with their computer.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yep. Nick, we agree with you.
I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Nick, you kind of nailed that one. Okay.
Nick, we agree with you that Linux needs some lovin' here from an advertising perspective. And I'm just going to play at this point an audio advertisement for Linux that if you have a podcast and you want to play it, we'll give you the link. It's Creative Commons licensed. So here goes.
Your computer has problems? Want to hear the industry solution? That's right. Your software isn't working, so what do they suggest? Use more software to solve the problem. Listen to what you're being told. They want you to purchase software so the software you already purchased will work. What? The problem is, we've come to think of this as being perfectly acceptable. So stop accepting. There's been a solution all along, but you've rarely heard of it. That's right. You've spent hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars over the years that you didn't have to. It's time for the secret to be told. Thousands of businesses, universities, and even Wall Street have been using Linux for years. What do they know that you don't? Linux is free. It doesn't need antivirus protection, and 99.9% of the software you'll ever need comes free as well. It's as easy as clicking a mouse. That's it. No more crashes, no more viruses, no more blue screens of death. And get this, with Linux, you don't have to reboot after installing new software. Linux runs on old hardware. No need to buy a new computer every time the industry decides to boost profits and release another buggy system. So why are you still paying for the privilege of using your computer? There's a better way. Linux.
There you go.
Our next email come from Sainty, who wrote this. He goes, hi. Hi, Saint.
Hi.
I heard Bill talking about fixing a Dell computer and ordering a hard disk from Dell. Why? I am sure you can purchase an equivalent replacement hard disk from any reputable online retailer like Newegg or Tiger Direct, unless, of course, the machine is still under warranty. I only just listened to the podcast. I expect by now the machine is fixed, but just wondered. Usually, I listen to it as soon as it becomes available. I really like the podcast. Keep up the good work. Saint E. Thanks, Saint. When did I say I was going to buy a hard drive from Dell?
I don't know.
Well, I know I had to order a restore disk. I wonder if that's what he means.
Yeah, maybe. But I would never order a hard drive from the manufacturer unless it was under warranty and that was one of their terms and conditions.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think if I've ever fixed one that was still under warranty, and I don't think so. I've had to order a hard drive restore disk because the person didn't want Ubuntu, silly person.
Right. Yeah, I remember you saying that about the restore disk, but I don't remember.
I would never buy a hard drive from Dell because I can get it from Tiger Direct or like Newegg for, I think, get a 1 terabyte drive for like $70 now. So I have no idea. But if I did, I'm a silly person.
Right. So, Sandy, We agree with you.
Yes, we do.
Okay, moving on. All right. So our next email is from Bruce. He has a suggestion and a criticism for Bill.
Oh, well. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yay.
Hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
In Going Linux 201, a user named Robert complained about frequently needing to authenticate in Fedora, I think it was. I thought you might suggest something like Puppy Linux, which runs the user as root. Puppy is holding steady at number 10 or 11 on DistroWatch, so some computer users are happy with what we think of as a 1990s attitude to authentication. I haven't used it for a while, so I could be mistaken, but it seems you never need to authenticate since you're already root, right? It simply asks you if you're sure you want to take the next step. There may be some other distros which also run the user as root by default or have a different approach to authentication, but I'm not aware of them. By the way, Bill sounded drunk in episode 200. I don't think it works as well for him as it does for Fab on Linux Outlaws. It barely works for Fab. I'm wondering whether Tom blew up his system in a failed upgrade as Ubuntu 10.04 approached end of life. I hope he's back soon. Keep up the good work. Do your research if you have time. Cheers, Bruce. Well, I don't know what was going on in episode 200, Bill.
I don't know. I listened to
that. Apparently, you sounded drunk.
I just don't know what you're talking about. You know, they don't realize that we record this in the morning, so I had to start really early.
Yeah, maybe that was it. You were just sleep deprived. You hadn't gotten enough beauty rest.
I don't know. But yeah, thanks, Bruce. I'll try not to sound drunk anymore.
There you go.
Okay.
I think this is our last email coming up here.
Okay. Sorry. It's just so funny when I read it. Okay. The funny part is I don't drink. At all.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Our next email comes from David, who wrote us about this a month ago. Sorry about getting it to it so late, David. David let us know that he has changed over his computer's file system from an EXT3 to an EXT4. He installed a fresh copy of Ubuntu 12.04 with a separate home partition and then copied his things back over to his drive. Before the formatting, he had 40 gigabyte of free space. Now that he's done, he has only about 25 gigabyte with the same data in exactly the same size partition. He followed up with this clarifying email. Well, in this case, I'm using the same drive before. And after the format change, the only reason there was a secondary drive involved was to act as a backup / holding space while I remade the partition table on the first drive. So I'm sure that's not the problem. Does it help to note that Gpartage says that I have 47.55 gigabyte of unused space on the drive, but Nautilus reports 27.1 gigabyte free space? I also have a question about the reserve space the drives keep when you make a new partition. Looking at the link you referred me to, they point out that the reserve is dedicated to keeping an open space for the admin in the event that the drive becomes full. Does this mean that there's no point having a reserve space on a data partition? Say a home partition? Because if that's the case, then I may as well take that percentage down to zero and just leave the system partition's reserve space as it is so that it will have the admin space as is normal. David.
Well, I don't know about this. It looks like Gpartite is accurately displaying the free space. He's obviously using exactly the same hard drives, exactly the same partition. The only difference is he's changed the format from EXT3 to EXT4. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the file manager, Nautilus in this case, is reporting 27 gigabytes, so about half the free space. So you wouldn't think that a reserve would reserve half the space, but I don't know. There's obviously something going on here with the X-T4 that's not going on with the X-T3, and I don't know what that is.
Do you think he might have left a partition? Or did he wipe out the whole? I mean, I don't see the big difference in it. I mean, I know there might be a, you know, a few megabytes difference, but I wouldn't.
Right. That's what I would expect as well.
But I don't know why it would be such a vast difference. I wonder if there's maybe a partition or maybe a swap file that he left on accidentally, or I don't know. I mean, it's a small drive to begin with, so it's kind of hard. I don't know what did he use to partition it, or did he use the Ubuntu installer? Did he just accept the default Ubuntu? Because there's a couple times they'll say install alongside.
He doesn't say how big his hard drive is. He's only talking about how much free space he has.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's installed Ubuntu with a separate home partition, then he has to had to do manual partitioning. So he's developed his own partitions.
Hmm.
It's just that there is
less space.
You know, before he's just imaged his hard drive, changed the format, copied the files back,
mm-hmm.
and now he apparently has lost, you know, almost 15 gigabytes worth of space. So or at least Nautilus is reporting that. Gparted seems to be reporting it accurately. But
yeah.
I don't know enough about this to be able to answer it, but perhaps one of our listeners does. So if anybody has a clear, simple answer to this and could relay it to us, feel free to email us or send it in a voicemail. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll give you all the contact information there.
Yeah. Well, I wish I knew more about it, but like I said, I have no clue on what's causing it. If you do figure it out, let us know. I'd be interested to find out how or what's causing it.
So that's it for this episode, Bill.
Oh, okay.
In our next episode, we have Computer America number 61. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the forums to leave your topic suggestion in the thread labeled Topic Suggestions. The forum is at forum.goinglinux.com, and the forums are back up again thanks to Door-to-Door Geek. And
thanks, Steve.
All of his minions.
Millions and millions of minions.
Yes. If you want to support our efforts, click the donate button while you're on our website. You can also send us an audio comment by email, and we'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And of course, our voicemail line is 1-904-468-7889. Lots of ways to get a hold of us. You can also find our show updates on Twitter, and you can tweet us back at goinglinux, or you can join our Google Plus community. Look for Going Linux Podcast in Google Plus. You can download the episodes from our website, or you can play them right from our show notes page. Until next time, thanks for listening.
73s. Hey, where'd I put that beer?
The music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.